Okay. Rolling? Great. Okay. Today is, wow, November 22nd. That's an auspicious date, 2010. The yahrzeit of John F. Kennedy, if I'm not mistaken. Also my wife's birthday. So if I forget November 22nd, I am in trouble. If you recall, there was a Fawlty Towers, one of the episodes where John Cleese wants to surprise his wife and she is furious that he forgot her birthday. Anyway, I want to say good morning to the students in front of me and to those listening around the world. What's fascinating is I just want to make a few comments, corrections, call it what you wish, with a student listening via the website by the name of Henry Silverman checked out Shulamit, and if I said the school was founded by Shaul Lieberman's wife, Dr. Judith Lieberman, I was wrong. It was founded in 1930, but when she came to the school, evidently in the early 40s, she became the dominant figure of that school, and I'm told that until today, a tremendous portrait of Dr. Lieberman adorns the office of the school or the foyer when you enter. I also want to mention that the Keen family, Arland and Dr. I.A. Keen, were kind enough to check out with the Hebrew Union College, and they emailed me as follows: here in Israel, HUC hold by 2 days Rosh Hashanah. In the United States, 90% of Reform congregations only celebrate only 1 day. So that answers our question, that I had a feeling that in Israel they do celebrate 2 days, and Chutz Laaretz, the overwhelming majority do not. What's interesting about Rosh Hashanah is that we ourselves, the Torah Jews, celebrate 2 days. So it's hard to understand how the Reform could abolish the second day. But nevertheless, that is the situation. What's most fascinating, again, is Jack Levinstein dealing with the Saul Lieberman, and this is quoted from blogs on the internet. Saul Lieberman in 1962 said, quote, "Nonsense is nonsense, but the history of nonsense is a very important science. In certain respects, it is more revealing than the history of sciences based on reason." And then when he presented Professor Shalom for the honorary doctorate, this again is a quote, "You know that I believe that mysticism is nonsense, total and complete nonsense. But the history of nonsense is scholarship." And the man who was about to speak knows more about the history of nonsense than anyone has ever known. And I don't know, you can take that as a compliment or a backhanded compliment as you wish, but that is Shaul Lieberman, according to a website introducing Professor Shalom, Geshem Shalom. Okay, now, last week, the heart of this year was devoted, we spoke about the non-kosher wine, the Rav, because of the Rav and Rabbi Radin, the minority opinion at least became minority opinion. If not for the Rav, they would have voted unanimously to permit non-kosher wine. But all those other questions, women from Minyan and Yantif Sheni, everything pales by comparison with the questioning of riding to Shul or riding to the temple on the Sabbath. And as I showed you last week, the way the tshuva begins, that, excuse me?
I don't believe that that's true, Rabbi Richter.
That, you know, that what's true?
The major change of the conservative movement was not driving to Shul. It was being done. It was a fait accompli.
No. I will be, first of all, don't argue with me. You're arguing with the chancellor of the JTS, Professor Sosh. That's number one. Number two, I'll add one word that will satisfy you. The major change in conservative halachic theology, okay, underline the word halachic theology, was to permit the driving to Shul on Shabbat. Until today, plenty of Jews who go to an Orthodox Shul, say it properly, drive on Shabbat. But I understand what Michael is saying, but by making that little emendation, I've solved the problem. But But what's very important for us is the way the tshuva began, and you should never forget that, that driving to the synagogue on Shabbos cannot be forbidden because automobiles did not exist at the time the Torah was given. And then it goes into other pilpulim of the Shenetzeri for the Gufa, Midasek, and everything we spoke about. Now, what's even more important for us as Torah Jews is to recognize that the three rabbis who wrote this tshuva were all born, bred, and educated in Torah institutions. And you have to understand, this was America of the 20s, this was America of the 30s. You could have the finest Torah education, and among them was a first-rate Talmud Chacham, Jacob Agus, who arguably may have been one of the top students to come out of the very yeshiva that you are studying in the 1930s. I can tell you that I yet knew people who spoke about Jacob Agus with reference, a London, a Talmud Chacham, and look where he wound up. So you have Jacob Agus, you have Teddy Friedman, you have the Rabbi Adler from Detroit, and here they are all signing on the dotted line. Now, the person who wrote the tshuva that opposed them was Rabbi Ben-Zion Buxa. Rabbi Buxa already was much more traditional. He too was a seminary product. I don't know his entire life story, but I wouldn't be surprised if his elementary education was in Torah institutions. And he spoke about the whole concept of writing and just totally desecrating the Shabbat. It turns into another weekday that's known as Shemiyat Torah. And I, again, anyone who's driven, particularly in Israel, or you don't have to go far, you take New York, you take Los Angeles, they call in New York City, there's the Long Island Expressway, right outside of the city. Anyone who's driven on the LIE calls it the Long Island Crawlway. So, Dailech Hakim Ibramisa. Someone just told me in Los Angeles they were driving a short distance during rush hour. What appears to be on a normal time, no more than 20 minutes, took them an hour and a half. And we've all had that experience, we've all had. And he speaks, there is work of a more direct sense, the tension of driving in traffic, of pressing against crowds, of being subject to noise, of waiting in line. All these are extremely exerting to the nerves of people. They make any trip a tiring experience. And of course, this brings us into the whole concept of Shabbat, which we can speak about endlessly, the concept of Melacha, the concept of Avoda. I do know, and this was quoted many times, that in the 1930s in London, they did research and they found that Orthodox Jews had less heart attacks than non-Orthodox Jews. And they attribute it to the fact that one day a week an Orthodox Jew does not answer the telephone, does not have that tension. I want to tell you that that research was just redone, I believe, in Israel, and they got the exact same results, that Orthodox Jews are less subject to stress and tension. Now, again, I don't know. I don't want to be a fool and tell you. You know, the Rebbe would get very hysterical when books came out, Judaism as a lollipop. Peace of Mind. You remember that book, Peace of Mind? And the Rav was hysterical. He ripped it apart in public. Yeah, you know, remember the Rav's words? Lieberman wrote the way we...
There was a reason for that.
There was a reason
for that. His idea was that religion...
I understand that a thinking person is always going to be caught up in tension, and there's the Hegelian dialectics, and we're going to deal with that actually in this very class down the line. But I just want to say I don't want to sound like Lieberman, and I'm not telling you to observe Shabbos because Orthodox Jews get less heart attacks. But it is something to think about, that we disconnect. That's the modern word that I've heard people use in Chabura to speak about coming back to Yiddishkeit and have all this problem accepting halacha. See, I'm going to talk about that. But I understand them, because you got to remember, we lend ourselves to bad press. In other words, if you've been living in Israel, you heard the way I introduced the Shia yesterday with Rabbi Avadya Yosef. If you've been living in Israel the last half year. So, I mean, just think this morning what you're greeted with. There was a raid on yeshivat yesterday. They found that the yeshivat in the greater Jerusalem area who are robbing the government, have robbed the government of millions and millions and millions of shekel. They have students who don't exist. They have phony identity cards. I mean, this is what's in the news this morning. Now, I got to give Rabbi Yashiv credit. Here's a man who's over 100 years old, who came out with a psak last night, that these people have a din of rodef, that because of their actions, they are endangering the entire yeshiva world. In other words, if you're robbing tens of millions of dollars, you can understand why the people will say, throw every yeshiva boy into the army. So Rabbi Yashiv came out with a psak, but this is publicity. And I don't have to tell you with the sexual scandals, and it goes across the board, the Haredi world, the Dati Lu'umi world. It's very, very frightening. And I don't have to tell you the robberies, the Shpinka, the Syrians this past summer, who were Yad Achad with the Ungarisher and the Pelisher. You remember my vote, that the love of money, it's not a year ago, it's this past summer. Oh, it's a year and a half ago. Right, it's two summers ago, correct. You're right. I was there when they let him away in handcuffs. So, you know, the publicity is terrible, so there are a lot of well-meaning Jews, and Mendel will bear this out, who want to come to Yiddishkeit, but they say, Orthodox Jews, they're robbers, they're thieves, they're phonies, they're this, they're that. So they're seeking on their own. And you'll hear them use the word disconnect. We use the word lametet malachat. You follow what I'm saying? And they use the word, Danny, disconnect. Now, but you have to understand, Rabbi Ben Simeon Buck's tshuva is very much correct. Leaving out all the malacha involved, if we were to permit driving and a guy blows a tire and he gets caught in a traffic jam, what kind of Shabbos is it? Forget about the malacha. The whole concept of Shabbos is gone. Now, he says as follows, and I want to tell you, this paragraph that I'm about to read, the Rav has said this many times over. Again, you have to understand, the Rav in the 50s and 60s was fighting a battle like any other American rabbi out in the battleground. It's hard for your generation to comprehend this, because today everyone is frum, it's fashionable, everyone is Shomer Shabbos, the New York Times writes about halacha. Remember I told you that singer who came to this, what's his name? Give me his name again, Scopes, what's his name?
Shine.
I should remember the name, Shine. Shine writes about boundaries. The New York Times picks up Shine, the Dvarei Torah that fella said got into the New York Times. I never saw the New York Times better, sharper, with clearer understanding of what Torah is all about. Boundaries is absolutely the word that one should use. But I want to tell you, this paragraph, I'll give you variations where the Rav said it, word by word. I don't believe he knew that Rabbi Buxer said it, but they're both saying the same thing. Weighing all the circumstances, we are prompted to reaffirm the ban against Sabbath travel. The fact that the ban, Michael, this is for you, is presently being violated by large sections of our people need not deter us from stating what we believe true and desirable. At the present time, the Sabbath is ignored in most other respects by great numbers of our people. Should we then appease their attitude and declare the Sabbath halacha generally inoperative? Jewish tradition knows many periods in our time when widespread violation of law was followed by a new one respect for it. One thinks of the tribute paid by Rab prior to coming to Surah, where he called it Rav Bigmatzah V'gada Bageda, the famous Gemara that Rav came to Surah, found they were doing terrible sins, and he fenced them in and got them to live properly. We have to do exactly the same thing today. And because the majority of Jews drive on Shabbos, doesn't make it permissible. I have to tell you what he's touching upon here, and I'll give you variations from the Rav, is one of the greatest problems we have as Jews living in the Western world. Do you know why? Because when Yitzchak Rubin went to kindergarten in Maimonides, it was a beautiful Monday morning in April, and the ganenet, the teacher, said to the class, "It's a beautiful day, children. Should we go to the library and see the beautiful books, or should we go to the zoo and pet the animals? And in good democratic fashion, listen to me very carefully. Anyone recognize what I'm pulling on you now? Anybody? Alexis de Tocqueville mean anything to you? In good, the gentlemen go back to college, your education is lacking. In good democratic fashion, the class voted 23-1. Only Yitzhak Rubin voted go to the library. Everyone else voted go to the zoo. The kids made fun of him. Tell me, who was right? The kids who voted to go see the monkeys, the lions, the chimpanzees, or Yitzhak who said go to the library and pull out Rakepit's books and see what individuals can achieve? Or pull out Harav Hagon Rebitzal Nayar's books. No, Rebitzal Na'ar. Excuse me, let me get, let me not confuse his pre-name and his later name. Bezalel, he has a golden pen.
Did you read it?
I've read every
book. The footnotes.
His daughter is sitting here. The more praise you give, the better she feels. Okay. Now, anyway, but you see what I just did? We live in a democracy. The whole debate about Israel, didn't Meir Kahane raise the issue? Are we a Jewish state or a democratic state? Didn't Aaron Barak, the Supreme Court judge who shaped law in the state of Israel, basically, who lives around the corner from me, who knows nothing about Yiddishkeit, it's amazing that a man could grow up the way he grew up, knows nothing about Yiddishkeit. He probably, I'm willing to bet you he can't open up a Gemara and upsug and adopt Midrashi and Taisvis. But it doesn't matter. He, in the Supreme Court, one of his famous rulings where he outlawed the import of treif meat. And I have to give him credit. This was Yitzhak. You don't remember this. In the 90s, he outlawed the import of treif meat. So he gave a ruling that, yes, it's a democracy, and according to the point of view of democracy, you should have the right to import treif meat, but it's a Jewish state. And here, the Jewish factor is stronger than the democratic factor. In other words, no one is going to die because he can't buy treif meat. You understand me, David? It's an interesting decision. But we live with this problem time in and time out. Tell me, why is democracy so important? Why is it such a great value? Because we're born in America. Because Yitzchak and I saw communist Russia. Ribbono shel Olam, after you see communist Russia, before I saw communist Russia, Yehuda, Eugene doesn't remember when he was my student in 70, 71, 72, I laughed at democracy. I quoted Alexis de Tocqueville, the French political scientist who visited America before the Civil War, and I would quote him and you know, make a whole case against democracy, and I was right. Because it's ingrained in democracy, the majority is right. They voted, go to the zoo. You follow me, Gil? The majority is right. Poor Yitzhak Rubin, the girls went like that. Shame, shame on you. You want to go to the library. What's with you? But we are Jews. Judaism is right. How do you reconcile that with democracy? And deep in our subconscious, as Michael said, if 95% of the Jews who go to temples, including my own relatives, many of your relatives, don't play games with me, Yehud, I know where you come from. Many of your relatives, many of my relatives, Mendel, many of your relatives, they drive to shul on Shabbos, doesn't make it right. And that's very hard for us, because subconsciously, we really believe the majority are right. Now, the Rav said exactly the same thing, that when it came to Mechitza, and everyone said to Rebbe in the 1950s, Rabbi Soloveitchik, what are you, an idiot? You're going to fight a battle for a mechitza? Who needs a mechitza? It's America. The majority don't want a mechitza. The people don't want a mechitza. It's old-fashioned. It's outdated. And the Rav said, word by word, since when is the majority always right? Since when does putting something to a vote make it acceptable? And the Rav gave a shocking example, which I don't even have to go into, Nazi Germany. Just think what Hitler did, and everything that Hitler did was legal. Just think communist Russia,
where you couldn't teach religion, that if you taught a kid religion, it was considered religious coercion. You were not allowed to teach someone religion until that person was 18 years of age. Do you understand what I'm saying? On the other hand, every kid who went to school in Russia was taught atheism, and the laws permitted it. It's not right. But this is what the majority voted. This is what their parliament voted. This is what the Communist Party voted. And just because majority voted, no one in the world will say killing Jews is permitted by law, even though Germany voted its approval of face 4-1. No one in with his right mind would say raising kids on atheism is fine, but teaching a kid religion is forbidden. And yet that was the law. And someone who taught a kid, if you made a bar mitzvah for your child, technically you could be arrested in communist Russia. Under Stalin, people were sent to Siberia, people were executed. Chabad has a long list. They should print out a book. Maybe the book exists. Maybe someone listening will tell me about it. Of how many Chabadnikim, including the Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe's father, were executed or exiled for teaching children Torah. And this was the law. I have to tell you, under Khrushchev, after Stalin's death, a certain thought came in. And religion was not persecuted the way it was under Stalin. Later, with Zionism, a different problem developed, because the Jew did not assimilate. According, I don't want to go into communist ideology now, but if you know communist ideology, you are a Soviet. There's no concept of a nationality. You are part of the world. The entire world will become Soviets. The entire world will live with the worker reigning supreme. The world belongs to the worker. And then Zionism became a terrible problem, because the Jew refused to assimilate. When Golda Meir appears in public at the shul, what was it, 1949, Rosh Hashanah in Moscow, and the word goes out, word of mouth, people to people, Jew to Jew, that the ambassador from Israel is coming to the Choral Synagogue for Rosh Hashanah, 50,000 Jews came out to stand outside the synagogue on Achapova Street to greet Golda Meir. I don't have to tell you how famous the picture is of Golda surrounded by thousands of Moscow Jews on Rosh Hashanah standing outside the shul. At that moment, Stalin went ballistic. But it was not so much against the Jewish religion as against the nationality which is part of the Jewish religion of the Jew. You with me, Matan? And that's when Stalin decided to send the Jews to Siberia, the labor camps, the concentration camps, and that's when he arrested the medical doctors. And all of you know, within a few years, he took ill, and they say today, books have been written, that he could have been saved had he had good doctors, but all the good doctors were either executed or languishing in jail because they were Jewish. And the doctors he turned to were drunkards on vodka who had no real knowledge of medicine, and he et gepeget viahund. It doesn't lend itself to translation. Now, then he says something else, which is very fascinating at the end, which is so true today. He says all this pressure on the rabbis that we should permit driving to shul on Shabbos comes about because people have forgotten how to walk. Now, does this sound familiar? How much has been written on the suburban generation? America is overweight. People have forgotten how to walk. And he says, many people live within walking distance of the shul, but they're just, to put it into modern language, too darn lazy to walk the shul. And there's no need for us to join with them and give in to their base instincts by permitting driving. Now, and he brings a proof which is very fascinating and open to discussion and can be very easily contradicted, but in his time it may have been true. And he says, you want a proof to this? On Rosh Hashanah, on Yom Kippur, so many more people walk to shul. On Shabbat they drive, on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, they walk, because Yom HaNarayim is so ingrained within them that they will not drive, they will only walk. If they can walk on Yom HaNarayim, then they can walk on Shabbat. No, is it true at that time? Absolutely. It's true about Orthodox synagogues too. As a matter of fact, from the point of view of Halacha, it's Narishkeit. Why is it Narishkeit? No, you tell me, because Shabbat is a Nisa Chiyuv Mita, and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are not. But from the point of view of the deep attachment, I remember Rabbi Yosef Weiss telling me he got a Shaila from someone in Washington Heights. This is 1954, Pesach time. He got the following Shaila. Erev Pesach fell on Shabbos. So these people wanted to know, until when can they eat chametz on Erev Pesach, Shabbat? And it turned out they go to work and they eat treif, but they will not eat chametz on Pesach. And you say, he was saying to me, take a look. They're working on Shabbos. They're eating in a treif restaurant downtown New York. It's not like today that every block in downtown New York you find a kosher restaurant. When I was growing up, there was not the only kosher restaurant you had in mid-Manhattan was Farm Foods, which that was very questionable. It was Machalo Shabbos, it was open, but they claimed, you know, vegetables, etc. There was the endless debate if you're allowed to eat in Farm Foods. I think they went to Rabbi Lichtenstein eating that. I remember the whole, all of why you were shaking. You see, Rabbi, you can eat there again. You don't know what he ate. It could be he only drank a cup of coffee. But nevertheless, you have to be careful when you go into a restaurant. Farm Foods was the eternal debate. Downtown, on the east side, and up on the west side, there were Steinbergs, all right. But it's not like today. But you see, people have certain commitments that it doesn't work logically, it doesn't work halachically. It works. Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, you walk. Today, is it true? Michael, I would venture a guess it's not true today. That generation, if you studied Rupture and Reconstruction by my classmate, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, if you studied Rupture and Reconstruction, you know what he describes there? That in Boston, all these old-time Europeish Jews who were Mechalel Shabbos, who does, but Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, they dove with more Kavana than David and Matan put together. Why? Because David and Matan never saw Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur in Litva, in Poland, in their lives. But they still remembered Vivi Mont Gedavent in the Alte Heim. You follow me, Danny? Chaim Soloveitchik is a genius. If he makes a point, you got to take it seriously. So, but today, as Michael will testify, the average person going to a temple is four or five generations removed from any real Yiddishkeit. What does he know about Rosh Hashanah and Kippur? If he drives the shoe on Shabbos, he drives the shoe on Rosh Hashanah and Kippur. Okay. I can tell you in West Hampton. I can tell you Eidet Nemana and in West Hampton, there are no sidewalks. There's a Sakonet Nefasha to walk on Shabbos. I can tell you that the famous Shiloh I got from Boker, my Talmud Rabbi Schneider, who teaches in Torah Shraga. So he called me with a Shaila, Shavuot night. I told you the story. If I didn't tell this, I told it last year. They called me with a Shaila. Shavuot night, the Reformed Temple invited him to present the entire evening about Orthodoxy. They want to hear about it. So I said to him, look, it's an interesting Shaila. You know, the whole question of cooperation with Reform. But I said, my policy before I answer is, what does the local rabbi tell you? Who am I, a paskin from here? He says, the local rabbi is sending me. It's Rabbi Kenny Branda, Rabbi Branda. So I said, the local rabbi is sending you, what's the Shaila? So I told him, as long as they know that you're Orthodox, represent Orthodox, and you're not dialoguing with a Reform and Conservative, I think it's a Kiddush Hashem. Anyway, he goes to the shul, and it turned into an unbelievable Kiddush Hashem because he had to walk home. It was an hour walk home. There are no sidewalks. So the police sent the car, and there were pictures in every Philitterium paper of the rabbi walking with a police car in front of him, explaining why he's walking Shavuot at night. So, okay, Rabbi Buxer wrote a tshuva. Obviously, what can I tell you? The majority of conservative Jews do not follow, but it's a fascinating tshuva in that particular paragraph, because the majority, both what they vote, it's a very deep thought. I don't know if he realized what he's touching upon here, but this is a struggle that everyone in this room has. We believe in democracy. Absolutely. After seeing communist Russia, I'm a great believer in democracy with all its faults. But more important than democracy is Torah Hashem Tamima. How do you work it out? And I quote the Rav, and you can look it up in Sanctity of the Synagogue. You will see exactly what I said, word by word, by Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik. Okay, that's driving. Nachum, yes.
I have colleagues who, my age, who ate straight the whole year and only eat to eat bread on Christmas.
One second. You had colleagues your age. Where were they raised?
In New York, they were conservative reform.
All right, the same. They're totally removed. I understand.
They wouldn't eat bread for the whole. They wouldn't eat bread for the whole Pesach.
Kol hakavod. The Sfadik. When I came in Aliyah, the 90% of the Sfadim were like that. The whole Masoratist concept, they were Mechallel Shabbos, but their wives went to Mikvah. I mean, it was an unbelievable thing. Today, of course, the Sfadik world has moved both ways. On one hand, it's come back, Begadol, Shas, and others, Rabbi Elbaz, and Rabbi, the Taimani, what's his name? Amnon Yitzchak, Rav Amnon Yitzchak. I mean, I listen to him, I get an epileptic attack. I mean, it's a different story. But, to see his shtick and to see him whip someone and they take movies of it. Oh my gosh, where are we in Iran?
We want to cover
and on the other hand, you have Sfadim, who are Ashkenaz, go to Hebrew U, go to Tel Aviv U, hate religion, religious coercion, all the shtuyot that circulate, they believe it. But all right, we have to have faith that it will be a greater tomorrow. Yes, Michael.
The only point that I wanted to make is that writing Shuva is absolutely critical and important. But its importance is the clash of the halakhic forces that existed within the conservative movement. In terms of modernity,
lifestyle,
the real changes were sociological changes that occur later.
I'm going to come to it. No, I'm going to come to it. But from the point of view, listen to me carefully. But from the point of view of halacha, halachic theology, that tshuva where it says writing could not be prohibited because it didn't exist at the time the Torah was given is a tremendous rebellion against the Shulchan Aruch and our whole concept of Torah Shabbat Peh. That's where that tshuva becomes
a
watershed. It becomes a watershed. And out of that
one... Right.
We're going to come to it. Give me a chance. We're early 50s, 54. Now, I just want to show you one other tshuva, and then I want to move in, and I'm going to show you an unbelievable document soon. Electricity on Shabbat. I need not tell you, if you can be matir driving, electricity is a lot easier to be matir, because Meikar Hadin, until today, electricity may only be a suffix isad d'oraita. It may not be havara. It may be that it's boner. It may be completing a circuit. And out of the side, the Chazonish said a suffix. Those were the Chazonish's famous words. So that's why with electricity, for instance, the Technological Institute and the famous Grumma switch, everything can be easier if it's suffix isad d'oraita. So we can come up with a grumma, with a suffix, with a sfaker, etc. However, tshuvot were written, of course, to be matir. And it was easy, but I want to read to you one selection. And what's fascinating here is I knew the rabbi. It's Rabbi Arthur Newlander. Now, I know when I mention the name Rabbi Newlander to you, it probably means nothing. He had a long life. He was born in 1896. He died in 1988. He was born in Hungary, and he already had his elementary 17 years of education he had in Hungary. came to New York 1903, went to NYU, went to the seminary, and he was ordained by JTS in 1921. He went into a rich career in the conservative rabbinate. His most famous shtella was ultimately in Far Rockaway. And my cousins belonged to his synagogue, that's how I knew him, belonged to his temple. And you have to understand, again, you can't judge by today. Far Rockaway was one of the most elegant, expensive communities in the New York area. It was a bastion of conservative Judaism. Wherever there was wealth, wherever there was money in New York, the conservative temples ruled. Not reform, because as I explained to you many times, the New York Jews were second generation, third generation greenhorns. Their parents had come over from Eastern Europe. They still had a folk milieu attachment to religion, to Yiddishkeit, was they verstanden is Yiddishkeit, what they thought is Judaism. Conservative Judaism was fabulous for them. American, yes. Jewish, yes. The melting pot, a little of both. And there was one Orthodox shul, then there were two Orthodox shuls there, the Rabbi Rachman shul, the Shaarei Tefillah, Rabbi Pelkowitz's shul, the white shul it was called, because the building was white on the outside, and they were like the lodestars. That orthodoxy finally has come to Far Rockaway. Today it's hard to believe, I don't think there's a conservative temple left in Far Rockaway. The whole area is filled with shtibbles. There in Israel became a shtibble, Shaarei Tefillah became an overgrown shtibble. They brought them, could you imagine, a tremendous shul, and they threw out the benches, and it's just tables and chairs, like an overgrown Beis Medrash. And I have no right to laugh, because they host me once a year, and they're among my warmest, finest supporters and friends, so I have no right to laugh. But on the other hand, it is laughable, because I spoke there when Rabbi Rachman was still rabbi. I spoke there, I should say, I davened there with Rabbi Rachman. I was a ben bayit. I spoke there when Rabbi Wurzburger was rabbi, and it was chairs and benches. There were no tables. And today I speak there, and it's mamish like one tremendous shtibble, ashrayayin rat hazot. Now, even my own relatives who belong to the conservative temple, as years moved on, they too got carried up with the swing. And my cousin, may he rest in peace, he had no background, but his wife had a background from Borough Park. She was my cousin. So they ultimately wound up in the Orthodox in Beth Shalom, in Rabbi Klapperman's shul. Today it's Rabbi Kenny Hain. So Rabbi Newlander was a bit of a Talmud Chacham. He learned in Europe. He came to America already a Talmud Chacham. He was not an American product. He viewed himself, if you knew him, he was a member of the Committee on Jewish Law. He would tell his congregants that if they reestablished the Sanhedrin, he will be a member of the Sanhedrin. In other words, this is the way he conducted himself. He had learning, and he had a certain guile about him, a certain shtanz that you felt, wow, our rabbi is not just a plain conservative rabbi, he is a future member of the Sanhedrin. Now, he wrote the tshuva permitting the use of electricity. And as I told you, it was the funniest story in the seminary, because in 1947, I think the year was, Louis Finkelstein bought a gift. Could you imagine the president of the seminary, chancellor, no, I think he was president then, he was chancellor already, could be, bought a gift for the students for Hanukkah. It's like Richard Joel buying gifts for all the students in YU. What did he buy? Time clocks to put into the dormitory rooms for Shabbos. And here at that moment in time, they're already talking about permitting electricity on Shabbos. That's in the rabbinical assembly. And he is buying time clocks. So I'm quoting Shabbos clocks, time clocks, a Shabbos clock. Call it what you wish, it's the same thing. Now, I'm quoting from Waxman, the same book I quoted from before, Tradition and Change, page 407. And in conclusion, Halachic consideration coupled with scientific evidence leads us to permit the use of electricity on the Sabbath. It is self-evident that this permission applies only to such uses as do not involve work prohibited on the Sabbath. Thus, we may permit turning on electric lights, telephoning, refrigeration, using a radio and television. But we cannot countenance the use of electricity for work prohibited on the Sabbath, such as cooking, baking, shaving with an electric razor, using the washing machine, or an electric iron. The prohibition is here derived not from the use of electricity, but from the nature of the work itself. Now, do you understand that distinction? This is fascinating. In other words, where it's only a prohibition of electricity, that prohibition doesn't exist. But if it's shaving, which cutting your beard on Shabbos, if it's washing dishes, a washing machine, washing clothes, baking, cooking, yes, you're using electricity, but the Yisum Halacha is a lot more than electricity, that would be prohibited.
No, no,
Reb Shlomo Zalman holds basically that this may only be Nisa de Rabbanon. In other words, so therefore he can be more makil with the gram, with the gram, Nisa de Rabbanon, that it's ke'ein malacha, you know, you don't have to be a big chacham, it's ke'ein, boner, maka bepatish.
Which one are you
going to
give me a straw for?
No, if it's Nisa de Rabbanon, you don't need a hatra. But he's more makil on like, in other words, you can be more makil on the secondary matters. In other words, he is not notre to say it's a dioraita, but he would never agree with this chas v'chalila. In other words, it's an Yisrael Rabbanan, Yisrael Rabbanan. But it, we can be more makil with the machon, the technology, everything involved with an automatic elevator, with all these questions that border on electricity, but touch many other klalim and pratim of Shabbat. But here's the unbelievable part of the tshuva. It must be clearly understood that whatever use of electric apparatus we permit on the Sabbath, we allow only on condition that use is in consonance with the spirit of the Sabbath. Thus, the telephone may be used to strengthen family ties, to foster friendship and neighborliness, to convey a message of cheer to the sick, or a similar davar mitzvah. But the telephone should not be used for shopping purposes, for making business appointments, much less a business transaction. Now, do you understand what's involved here? I want to ask you a simple question. Danny, how do you get along with your mother-in-law? Are you allowed to call her on the Shabbos to wish her well? You follow me? Where do you draw the line? You got a big business deal coming down. So you're calling your partner, not to talk about the business deal, but to tell him, you better rest on Shabbos, don't go golfing, we got a big week ahead of us, we have big decisions to make. Where do you draw the line? Similarly, in the use of radio or television, common sense should dictate that only such programs may be indulged in which are not vulgar and banal, and do not desecrate the sanctity of the ideal Sabbath. Only programs of high aesthetic taste, of high ethical content, instructive and of social value, are in keeping with our concept of Shabbos Kodesh, and only such programs should be listened to and seen on the Sabbath day. Now, wow, does that open up a Pandora's box? You have a DVD of Barefoot in the Park, a Neil Simon comedy. Can you see that on Shabbat? Can't you see it on Shabbat? It's not vulgar. It has interesting comments. You can discuss husband-wife relationship, mother-in-law, daughter-in-law relationship. Gentlemen, ooh, wow, how do you handle it? Faulty Towers. At times, it can be risque, but But that's only 2% of the time. Seinfeld, vulgar, stupidity, lack of responsibility, but funny as heck, allowed or not allowed. Everyone loves, what's that program? Kramer, the Italian fellow, nice guy. He's a big Ohev Yisrael. He grew up with Jews, went to school with Jews. It's like Donald Trump's daughter. She said that I'm becoming Jewish. What's the chiddush? All my life I've been friendly with Jews, went to school with Jews. No, can you watch Raymond? Raymond, fabulous. The in-laws, the children, but at times vulgar than vulgar. Now, let me just tell you something between the lines for your edification. Are you familiar with Raymond? Raise your hands if you're familiar with Raymond. Tell me, do you know his mother-in-law? His mother, I should say. The chubby little Catholic woman who plays his mother, right or wrong? Nachum, you know his mother? Raymond's mother, Baruch Hashem. You should know her great nephews go to school with my grandchildren. She's Jewish. And two-thirds of the family has Ruba Tshuva. It's a very prominent family in Teaneck. I don't want to mention the name. They may be ashamed of her. She's a cousin on a Brekel Yiddishkeit. And you should see her nephews, her great-nephews. It's beyond words what has happened. But the honeymoon is new. The honeymoon is allowed to watch. Godless. Allowed to watch. The honeymoon is no pornography. I'm not making a joke out of anything. But where do you draw the line? Anyway, Einachinami, Mission Impossible. Where do you draw the line? Gentlemen, you know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of the problem with the internet today, with the kosher internet and various systems that censor out. So if this Rabbi Dr. Newlander is right, the conservative movement would have to set up a book of guides, a code book, what you can watch, what you can't watch, what is rated acceptable, what is rated unacceptable. Excuse me?
The Catholics have that.
I understand, that's good. They have on what they call the index, the books it's called, the index. Of course. Anyway, be it as it may, it's a funny tshuva, it's a funny response, and it lends itself to endless discussion. But obviously, once you permit electricity, once you permit driving, everything falls. Okay, I'm ready to move further.
Aren't there early halakhic sources from the 20s and earlier?
Yep. About what?
Legitimate Orthodox sources permitting electricity?
Not on Shabbos, on Yom Tov. On Yom Tov, not on Shabbos.
At the most,
you have in the response literature. David, do me a favor, close the door. Or Gil, close the door. Thanks, you're closer. Rabbi Rosenberg, his grandfather in Montreal. The most that you have on Shabbos is the Mho Machlokes, whether it's the Raisa or the Rabbanon, etc. No one ever permitted electricity on Shabbos. No one. With Yom Tov, there were many matirim, and that we spoke about many times in class. That is, man is already known as matir, because they're more not choishish for havara, but they're choishish for makab patish and binyan, and because you're closing a circuit. Okay.
Just in terms of the second part, though, don't we make judgments about what topics we can talk about, what's acceptable to read? What kinds of songs are acceptable?
That's what I said to you. It reminds me of the whole question of the computer, of everything going on today, the Haredi world. But I'm just showing you, he puts it in on Shabbos, that every individual have to decide what TV programs he can watch or can't watch. What about a Yankee game? What's wrong watching a Yankee game, a Brooklyn Dodger game, etc.? Okay, it lends itself to endless... But
I had a friend that drops his Shabbos menucha was listening to Mudgett's records.
Unbelievable. Okay.
A Rav who had a tremendous impact on me was someone I worked for in a small show. He was a YU graduate, with good credentials.
Right.
He eventually went to Florida and became a rabbi there. And I went to visit him one Shabbos afternoon. 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a winter afternoon, his television goes on. He wanted to watch something, and he found it perfectly acceptable to put his television on a Shabbos party.
The Rav Asid, that very shot of the Rav Asid. But anyway, be it as it may, that's a very different than turning the television on. You understand? Here, they're permitting you to turn the television on, but only for a positive reason, not a negative.
Why was that Isur? The
Rav felt Anisa Malachit was not, but in the spirit of Shabbat it was not. The Rav felt it felt under the category of Muksa, the way the Rambam describes it, the Ramban and the Rambam, that it has to be a different day. And if your Shabbos is just like any other day, and in the middle of the day you watch the Notre Dame Army game at Yankee Stadium on television, it's not Menuchat HaShabbat.
You're making Shabbos
cold. Yeah, that's it. It's not Menuchat HaShabbat.
The scriptural law accepts.
To say there's an Issa Malacha, there's no Issa Malacha. To say it's not in the spirit of Shabbos, absolutely not.
That's part of the halacha too.
I agree. That's what I'm explaining to him. But he's asked me in a strict halacha. You're
right,
Malacha.
Yeah. Did he mention Michael specifically?
Who are we talking about, Leibold? He doesn't discuss Leibold. Could be the contestant. Okay, it doesn't matter. We've made the point. Now, gentlemen, while all this was happening, and here's what Michael Miller has been saying, and I want to articulate it now. While all this is happening, the storm raging out across conservative Jewish America is indescribable. We have that storm right in our world at this moment in time. The Haredi world does not have this storm. Haredi world says very simply, there's a way we live, it's the only way we can survive as Jews. We are pulling the wagons around the teepee. We dress a certain way, we act a certain way, we speak a certain way. Our mentality is very similar. That's the Haredi world today. Open up Art Scroll, you'll see it in their historic volumes, in their Musa volumes. You'll see it time and again. There's a little medrash, I looked into it. It literally, black and white, desecrates Yeshiva University as if it's a conservative institution. That's the Haredi world. Now, it's not to say they don't have problems. I'm not that naive. They have plenty of problems and plenty of kids falling away and plenty of difficulties, and we're all aware of it. But you have to give them credit. They say, this is halacha. We don't budge. Even where it's not halacha, and I want to be careful in my words so Michael Miller doesn't shoot me down. Even where it's not halacha, we do not budge. We stand firm. And this is the whole concept of black hat. I've told you more than once, you see a 13-year-old kid with a tremendous black hat on. But you got to admire the message that they are giving this kid. And 90 or 85% of the time, the children will keep that black hat on 5 years later, 10 years later, 20 years later. You take the conservative movement, and from all that we've seen, they made changes. Solomon Schechter, the Mechitza, Mordechai Kaplan, belief in God, Louis Ginsberg, who was certainly more traditional than most, nevertheless permitted a synagogue to have men on one side, women on the other side, men and women in the middle. Well, once you start to make changes, it's a big world out there. It's a beautiful world out there. People are ignorant of Judaism compared to the way they know Western culture. They're going to college. They're going to graduate school. And the world is shaking. Following Vietnam and the successful rebellion of the youth and the liberals, and the realization, which may be absolutely part of our modern culture today, a war cannot be won against people fighting on their own home territory. And there's no need to fight them. Let them live, let them do. Who cares? They're communists, they're not communists. What does it bother us? You all know what went on in the 60s into the 70s until America capitulated. With the Arabs, the same controversy rages today. The Islamic culture, if you're familiar with the Quran, if you listen to what's being said, They're out to destroy Western civilization. They're out. You see what they're doing to Christians in their own countries, Iran, Iraq, Turkey. Literally burning down churches, bombs exploding. But many in America say it's not our concern. Let them do what they want there. We live in freedom. We're different. And they imbibe of the trends that are happening. And by the late 60s into the 70s, you have this tremendous sexual revolution that is changing the face of human behavior. Could you imagine today the future king of England gets engaged to this girl that he's been living with how many years already? 4 years, 6 years, 8 years. There's a whole machlokes how many years they were apart for a few months. And this is called an engagement. When his mother got engaged, there were tremendous headlines, she is still a virgin. Or to quote Dennis Prager, if you went to high school in the 1950s in New York City, it didn't matter whether you went to Yeshiva High School or to a general high school, you would have gotten the same set of basic ethical moral values. Comes to sex, everyone's a virgin until marriage. If you're not a virgin, it's a disgrace. Today, it's a disgrace if you are a virgin in Western culture. They laugh at you. Marriage, what does marriage have to do? Marriage is, you want to get married, have children, get married. Sex is no different. Eating, drinking, it's a physiological need. You're 14, you're 15, you're old enough. You're old enough. As long as you practice birth control, don't impregnate the girl, quote, end quote. I've seen this in, forget about America, secular schools in Israel, the instructions that the Mechanchim gets from the Board of Education here, you read it, you have to rip Kriya. That's how distant it is from anything Jewish, anything sacred, holy. Husband-wife is the foundation stone of the Jewish people, and our whole future depends upon the sanctity. But in America, it's blown away. I don't have to tell you what happens afterwards with homosexuality. I mean, who would ever dream that intelligent people would consider a marriage of man and woman, to women, to men, all the same? Who would ever dream? I hear the rough talking in the 70s where this began. Who would ever dream it would hit the Jewish people? But when you're out there and you're exposed to dual culture, it hits home. It hit the Reform movement first. 10, 20 years later, it hit the conservative movement. And right now, 10, 20 years later, within the parameters of the Torah world, we have tremendous battles with this very, very topics. I need not tell you. The letter on homosexuality and being more accepting and making it normative was penned by my own student from this very kollel, a member of the Chobevei Torah faculty. I don't have to tell you how many rabbis signed on, some of them my own students, some of them my colleagues, who I know for 50, 60, almost 70 years. So that you can have all in the ivory tower, as Michael said, they're debating. But once you break down the barrier, the people are yelling and shouting for more and more and more. They are not learned. They don't care. They don't know what Yirat Shemayim is about. They don't know what the Vahashem Zu Halacha is about. They don't know what Torah Shemitah is about. Torah Shemitah. These are all alien terms to today, 75%, 80% of American Jewry. And I'm not overstating the case. Israel is different, but we're not talking about Israel. We have our problems here too, but it's on this level, it's more minimized. These are tremendous problems. The Haredi world stands firm and it tells you, this is halacha, take it or leave it. We're not here to sell it, we're not here to compromise it. I don't mean to say only the Haredi world, believe me. In the greater Yeshiva University world, the OU world, the Young Israel world, certainly the statement is being made as well. I believe that Aaron Rakefet makes it very succinctly and clearly over the last 52 years, Baruch Hashem. But nevertheless, we are more exposed because we're living in the big world. And we cannot deny the fact that we go to college, we go to graduate school, we read the New York Times, we read novels, we're up to date with everything happening in the greater world around us. Is it good to be part of the greater world? Not good? All right, that's an open question. But all of us here live, Ger V'tosha V'nochi Machem, as I've quoted the Rav so many times. Now, by the 1970s, this was building into a crescendo in the conservative movement. You have the JTS faculty, you have the rabbinic assembly, but you have the reality on the ground that's going on with every conservative temple you can imagine. To give a simple example, Har Zion was the biggest conservative temple in America. Winfield, section of Philadelphia. The most important conservative rabbis were there. Rabbi Simon Greenberg, from there he goes on to become vice chancellor of the seminary. It was a powerhouse. Har Zion? Very few people drove the temple on Shabbat. Innovation? Mixed seating. Nothing more. Certain Hasidic Rebbe, I've been challenged on this. I will stand on what I remember. I was not there. I never davened in a conservative temple in my life. But when I came into Lower Merion Synagogue in 1961, everyone told the story about this Hasidic Rebbe of Philadelphia, whose grandson was being bar mitzvahed in Har Zion. So he came for Shabbos. No, what do? To daven? They built a mechitza around the Rebbe. You follow me? Instead of building mechitza between the men and women, they built a mechitza around the Rebbe. So people have argued me, told me, no, it was a bit of a mechitza, it kept the women away from the Rebbe. I heard the story, they built a mechitza around the Rebbe. But even explaining they built a little mechitza to keep the women away, it's yet quite a comment on Philadelphia and Har Zion and this Hasidic Rebbe that he davened in Har Zion. Then Har Zion opened a branch in the suburbs. Believe me, everyone drove the shul on Shabbos. Everyone came out by car. People only started coming already when there was a special occasion. Rabbi Simon Greenberg said to me, to these very years, remember I told you his son Moshe was one of my finest balabatim. He said to me in 61, quote, our greatest tragedy is not that we permitted driving to synagogue on the Sabbath. Our greatest tragedy is that even though we permitted it, the temples are empty on the Sabbath unless there's a bar mitzvah. Quote, end quote. I mean, you got to understand what was happening. There's a book that I highly recommend to you, The New Rabbi. It came out in the early part of this decade. It's about Har Zion today. New Rabbi Chaim Potok was a member of Har Zion. You got to know who Chaim Potok was. Chaim Potok was raised an Orthodox boy in the Bronx. I know he was his brother was my dearest classmate, Simon. Chaim was the older brother. My first book, I owe Chaim Potok the greatest thanks. He taught me how to write. He read the manuscript on Rabbi Revel. He edited it. Yeah. Rabbi Gil's student edited the new manuscript. But my first book, Rabbi Chaim Potok edited. And he taught me tricks in writing. And you know, he was part of that conservative movement, but was what you call the Ramah conservative. It was a different type, not the type you know today. And you got to read this book, how disappointed they later were with what became of Har Zion. But once, he was disappointed. In the book, it tells you, not what we dreamt of, etc. You got to read the book, you have to see it. It's a fabulous book, written by a good author, a newspaper man. Yeah, what did you want to say?
You're mixing two different Har Zions.
Well, I'm talking about the one, and then they had their branch.
Har Zion moved...
To the main line.
To the main line in 1976, 77.
Right, that's right around the time.
The Radner branch
right.
opened, I would say, in 1969, 1970.
Right.
And there were two different worlds.
Right, not the same.
The world of Radner was the suburban world.
Right.
The world of Har Zion 54th Street... with Rabbi Goldstein, Goldstein before Rabbi Wolpe, was an urban world in Winfield.
Right, I understand.
And still, the majority, not majority, I don't know percentage, but a tremendous percentage still walked.
Right, right, that's what I just said.
And they closed in 1976, and they moved to the suburbs to Penn Valley.
Right, and there too, it the whole atmosphere changed. You got to read the
book. Bogart was long gone.
Right, okay, so he would be called back, he had connections, this was part of, he read the book, and he was very disappointed when he saw what came out of it, but it doesn't matter, The point is, the minute you show you can make an ovation, the minute you give a finger, they clamor for a hand.
I mean, they hired
a reconstructionist rabbi. It's all in the book, you got to read the book, it's a fabulous book. Okay, now, in 1973, there was an interesting battle for the presidency of the seminary. These are names that are long since forgotten, unless you're a student of the conservative movement. The battle was 1973 already. You got to remember, Louis Finkelstein, more than anyone else, was Mr. Seminary. No one could compete with Louis Finkelstein as the most prestigious individual, the administrator, the guide. But he was on in years, not in good health already. They needed a new president. Who are the two candidates? Professor Gershon David Cohn and Professor Bernard Mandelbaum. Now, these two people were both seminary faculty members. Gershon Cohn is more into Jewish history. Bernard Mandelbaum was more into Medrash, Haggadah.
Like Finkelstein.
Neither of them were on Finkelstein's level.
But he was something
towards Finkelstein. Two wonderful individuals from the faculty. What was the difference between them? Gershon Cohn was already innovative. I'll quote to you when he retires. He had to retire because of ill health. He didn't have a long reign in the seminary. He's already more innovative. He was already more accepting of the tremendous pressures that were building outside the seminary. Bernard Mandelbaum, who I'm related to through marriage. Anyone here know my cousin? He's a dentist, Josh Daniel. Name mean anything to anyone? Josh Daniel is related to Bernard Mandelbaum. Josh Daniel, how does the relationship work? It may be that Bernard Mandelbaum is married to his father's sister or his father's sister-in-law. Check it out. Bernard Mandelbaum was a Borough Park Jew, was a Frum Jew 100%, not open to innovation, traditional with a capital T. It's a big battle. Gershon Cohn won. You could no longer elect the president who was orthodox in practice. By now, the outside forces, United Synagogue, the lay people, some of the rabbinic assembly, clamoring, yelling, shouting. And you could feel the changes happening in the thinking of the very heart of the conservative movement, the Jewish Theological Seminary.
What year is
this? This election was 73, but it's indicative when they elect Gershon Cohn, and you got to remember, the most important faculty member of the seminary to the new generation is becoming irrelevant. Professor Shaul Lieberman. The new generation looks at him, you see, it's just the opposite of what happened at YU. As the Rav aged, and Professor Liebman and the Rav both age basically at the same time. The Rav lives longer, but not really. It's the last, Lieberman dies in 83. By 83, the Rebbe is a Sheva Kli. He stops teaching in 85.
Rav David Milovich contacted me, Menachem Avin, the Rav.
Yeah, no,
he was there.
He took the Rav to the... They basically, their lives paralleled each other to a certain degree in America, because Liebman comes to the seminary faculty in 1940 and the Rav comes to the YU faculty in 1941. So basically they parallel each other with their influence. As the Rav grew older, he became more important, more valuable. You know, it's sad when you think of it, because when he was in his prime, the 50s, into the 60s, there weren't that many students. In my class with the Rav, you had 30, 35. Didn't have more. You see from the picture that in my office of the classroom. But by the 70s, you had 125 kids, young people sitting there. The Rav already was aged. He didn't have energy. He couldn't teach all that he wanted. I can tell you off the cuff, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik once said to his father, this is what I was told by the Gaboyim, that Reb Chaim said to his father, Dad, look how the students are becoming so right-wing. They don't understand you. They don't understand your message. They don't understand Torah. You know, the 70s, the swing to the right. You should give them a class in Hashkafah, in philosophy, in Chumash, like you did in the 50s. And you know what the Rav answered? Ich hab nicht kein Koyach. I don't have the energy. Quote, that's what I was told. Sammy, I wasn't there, but that's what I was told by reliable people. And it's a very fascinating comment, because in the 50s, the Rav taught in Bernard Revel Graduate School. The Rav gave courses on philosophy, on tefillah. People until today say you couldn't believe what the man was capable of. Some of the books that have come out, some of the unfinished symphonies, are manuscripts from that period. But as the Rav grew older, the students held on to him, worshipped him. They understood he's a link. They understood this is the Platos of Rehem. Believe me, Gil, I want you to know, Rakepit is as big a Zionist as anyone in this room. Will you agree to that or not? Okay, my Zionist credentials are okay. 42 years, Alat Mata Kodesh, 15 years in the army, etc., etc. All right. I get up many times before an Israeli audience and say, Ani ha'ish achim ushab olam ki atem tipshim. I'm the happiest guy alive, because you Israelis are a bunch of dopes. So they all look at me, you know, calling them a dope doesn't bother them, but they want to know why they're dopes. I say, because you didn't elect the Rav, Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv in 1935. And they elected the Rav, Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv in 1935. Ani Rothkopf and Eugene Singer would have never been exposed to Bris, to Reb Chaim, to Gatler, to a mind, to a heart that was second to none. You follow me? Yitz Rubin, Bet Gelicht and Drad. Where would he know the Rav? He grew up in Boston. Who would his rabbi have been? I'm the happiest guy alive that they were such fools in Tel Aviv. They didn't elect them. But we held on to the Rav. You got to understand it. When Yitzchak and his friends and Moshe Parsek, I remember they came from Maimonides to New York. I'm going to tell Yitzchak something he may not remember. They said to me, wow, look at the respect they give the Rav here. They couldn't believe it. Whenever we saw the Rav from afar, we jumped up. They're a Cheretz, the Rav. In Boston, he says, we don't jump up for the Rav, you know, we take it for granted. We're one of the boys, right? But in New York, wow. In the seminary, they were looking at Lieberman as a fossil already. I'll say it even stronger, but not yet, as a fossil. He's yesterday's news. It's a new generation. I'm going to show you a document. I think we'll have to end with this document today. It's unbelievable. A document that appeared in every Anglo-American Jewish newspaper. I believe it even appeared in the New York Times. And this document, let me see if I can, I believe it appeared, yeah, it appeared right before Rosh Hashanah. 1983. And this document just gives you an entire new insight into what was happening and what's about to happen in just a year or two away in the conservative movement. 1983, the seminary had endless members, conservative Judaism, I should say. They were on top of the hill, endless money. No one would ever dream then that a time would come when the seminary would have to send faculty member away, cut back salaries, etc., etc., all that's happening today. No one would ever dream that a time would come that YU would have wealthier donors than the seminary. Seminary was on top of the world. And every year before Rosh Hashanah, they ran an advertisement. This advertisement said it all. It's based upon the Gemara in Menachot, Daf Chav Tet Amid Bet. My son-in-law wrote about an 80-page essay, was published in Jewish Thought, with a magazine that doesn't exist today, on this very Gemara. What happened in the Gemara? Famous Gemara with Rabbi Akiva, Moshe Rabbeinu, that, you know, with Rabbi Akiva's martyrdom, Zoti Torah, Zoti Schara, and how Moshe Rabbeinu is shown all the future generations. And he comes into the Beis Medrash and he's shown Rabbi Akiva giving a shir, and Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't understand it. And finally, Rabbi Akiva has to say, Halacha l'Moshe m'Sinai, that it goes back to Matan Torah, and it all goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe Rabbeinu, Baruch Hashem, feels very happy, issues a sigh of relief. It's a merit Gemara. All right, what is this Gemara telling us? So I'm just paraphrasing the Gemara. Look up the Gemara. It's overwhelming if you don't know it. What is this Gemara telling us? And here you come to the heart of what we believe is Torah Jews. The process of chiddush, of innovation, has never come to an end. God created us with good, wonderful minds. Every generation adds to the Torah Shabbat Peh. Every generation can have innovativeness. Every generation can have chidushim, or novellas in proper English. This is part of the halachic history, or the halachic process, or the dynamics of the halacha. Call it what you wish. But all our innovation and all our chidush is circumscribed within the concepts of Torah Shabbat Peh, how we can, what we can, and it all goes back to Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai. So, for example, in modern times, you have the Vilna Gaon, you have the Baal Shem Tov. As the Rav always said, you have Rav Chaim Brisker. You have within the Hasidic world so much different thought of the early part of the 20th century. Of course there's chiddush, of course there's innovation. But it all works within a certain rubric of the Torah Shabbat Peh, of the oral tradition, of the rabbinic tradition. And this is Halacha L'Moshe M'Sinai. And this is what the Gemara means. And there's a very powerful Gemara in Chulin, at the start of Chulin, I believe it's Daf Zayin. I've often quoted that Gemara. You know, Ararat Kefer, who the hell is he? Come on. Kid from the Bronx, wasted his youth, Yankee Stadium. Eugene's biggest yichus is that his father owned the pharmacy, worked in the pharmacy, right around the corner, right under Yankee Stadium on Jerome Avenue. All the gedolim of Shebaris used to come in, they were dead drunk after a game. Babe Ruth, Louis, Lazari, all the gedolim there. Right. You can imagine. And they used to sober up in his father's pharmacy. No, that's his big yechus. And yet, take a look. We can sit in Jerusalem and we can give the most innovative lectures. Whoever gave lectures under the summer Rosh, whoever showed you a problem with shaving Whoever showed you a problem, too much davening, the interconnection between the era and the tradition. It's unbelievably fascinating. Wait till I'll show you next week with what he comes up with the Kabbalah, with secular study. There's no end. Come on. Who the heck is right? This is a serious question. Who gives you a right to come in with these innovative shiurim, innovative ideas? Look what I did yesterday with Drush on Geffen Publishing, with red wine and white wine, and the red of Jewish life and the white of Jewish life, and the Baruch HaTov HaMeitiv that you make over two different wines. Innovative or not? What do you say, Danny? Who gives you permission? So the Gemara asked this question. A little humility. Who is Yitzrub? And he gives wonderful lectures. He's organized. You don't know yet. He's a Boy Scout. When he gives a lecture, everything is written out. His students benefit. Who gives you permission? How can you do it? Who are we? So the Gemara says, Makom. The Gemara asked this very question. Doesn't mean we're greater than Moshe Rabbeinu. Makom hinichalo avotav lehitgader bo. That this is the way God made the world. That every generation leaves for the next generation a little insight that you can be original, you can be machadesh, you can be innovative, you can do your own thing. And yes, we're different, Makom, but while we may be different, it is all within the boundaries of Torah Hashem Tamimah. And that's the way we understand, everyone understands the Gemara in Menachot. It's a beautiful Gemara that so many generations has passed by until Rabbi Akiva came along, and Rabbi Akiva had an unbelievably brilliant mind, and he could dashen al kol tagin endless halachot, as the Gemara says, and Moshe Rabbeinu was overwhelmed. And then his mind was put at ease. Halacha l'moshe misinai. I give you mashallah mahadava domer. I have students that could throw up so many different sources. You hear them give a lecture in vaftam and vaftam. So on one hand, I think they're terrible lecturers because they're confusing the audience. You understand? I've told you more than once. When you get up to lecture, your job is not like a chatan. It's an expression in Yiddish. It's minas hachasen bam chasana. It's not that I have to show off and give a drasha at my wedding. Your job, and by the way, my wedding and my drasha changed my whole life, but that's a different story. That's a real story. You can ask Rabbi Heschel Schechter, and if he doesn't remember all the details, I sure do, but he remembers too. David, yes, I'm proud of my students. And then at the end of 100 sources they mention, 99 which I didn't know, they say, and then I heard from my Rebbe, Harav Rakefet and Chris Kolel, and then I feel better, Baruch Hashem, that they have to come back to the earlier generation. That's the Gemara in Menachot. It's a powerful, beautiful Gemara.
What is the relevance of this Gemara to the election of Gershon?
If you only had patience, you will live to be 120. That's the Gemara in Menachot. Watch. 1961, I come to Lower Merion Synagogue, and I mention something against the conservative movement, and Moshe Greenberg challenges me. And Moshe Greenberg takes an approach that we know more than the Vilna Gaon. Okay? I said, what do you mean we know more than the Vilna Gaon? We have sources he didn't have. We have manuscripts he didn't have. And therefore we know more, and if we know more, we can make changes. Gentlemen, the conservative movement publishes an ad in 1983 that is an exact reflection of the words that Professor Zichrono Livracha Moshe Greenberg taught me, argued with me, in 1961. We know more, we have more today. We understand better. Moshe Rabbeinu came into Rabbi Akiva's Beis Medrash. Who know more? Rabbi Akiva. Yes, it may go back to Moshe Rabbeinu, but there's a halachic process at work. The historical school, remember those words? We know more today, and therefore we can make changes. To answer Yitzhak's question, Professor Mandelbaum was not elected because he was not in favor of change. Professor Gerson Kohn, who understands the Gemara in Menachah Daf Chaf Tet Amid Bet, he was elected because he understands that we know more today, and therefore we can make changes. And this advertisement is literally the seminary about to implode halachically. Now, let me just read to you. The wording here is unbelievable. The Talmud tells us that God himself transported Moses to the classroom of Rabbi Akiva in the 2nd century to show him that there were meanings in the Torah that Moses had never imagined. If we met God today as Moses did at Sinai, would we receive the same Torah? Think about it. Revelation must depend in part on the listener. Our ancestors heard at Sinai what they were capable of hearing. If Revelation ended at Sinai, then all later experiences, Jeremiah's, Akiva's, ours, is redundant. And the accumulated learning of civilization is pointless, even ungodly. But Revelation continues. It builds. The interpretation of one generation becomes part of the text for succeeding generations. And then in big black letters, we can hear a little better all the time. If we are listening, we are listening. Sinai was not our final list of commandments. We have always taken new mitzvot upon ourselves to mark the Sabbath and holidays in new ways, to establish synagogues and to compose liturgy, to ordain rabbis, to engage in daily prayer, to support the state of Israel, to educate our daughters. The growth of understanding is God's gift to us. If study led merely to making ourselves into the image of our ancestors, we would be denying the growing body of human knowledge, the expanding conscience of the sensitive, and our own contemporary insights. We would be practicing a masked form of idolatry. Nostalgia alone is not enough. You ready? We can understand God's message better than Akiva. We have history, archaeology, literature, philosophy, psychology, as well as the Talmud and the thinking of our great scholars, the accumulated wisdom of humanity. We have to use it all. We have to constantly rethink. What is expected of us as people, and specifically as Jews? This is not a task for rabbis and scholars alone. It has never been. We have always been a community of thinking, daring, studying people who increase the power of God's law by living it and growing with it. Each new year depends that we open ourselves again to revelation, to listen, to learn, and to act. I'll make a Xerox, okay? It's this document, I cannot tell you.
Pure poetry and emptiness.
No, don't. It's not emptiness at all. This document is extremely powerful because what this document is telling you, times have changed. Times are different. We don't want to be bound by Professor Lieberman. We are smarter today. We know more than Rabbi Akiva. It's exactly Moshe Greenberg, who I told you, he was very kind to me in a very difficult year in my life, a year that shaped me. and forged me, but a year that could have destroyed me. I was very young. I was younger than anyone sitting here. We left yeshiva 23. I knew how to learn better than you know how to learn today. We knew how to learn much better in our time. So whatever the reasons are, we didn't have art scroll. But I didn't have the maturity you have. You're 25, 26. You're older when you go into the rabbinate. 27, you have much more maturity. I did not have that maturity. And I'm not here to criticize Moshe Greenberg, but it's unbelievable. We know more than the Vilna Gaon. We know more than Rabbi Akiva. We can make the changes we need. Times have changed. You have to listen. It's an amazing, amazing document. So wait, let me just, I'll take the questions in a minute. Let me just reiterate. It's quite a class today when you think about it. It's got a lot of meat to it and a lot of thought, but I've just prepared the stage. Next week is the overthrow. We'll see what comes out of this. But coming back. Yes.
Did you mention why is electricity awesome?
What, why, what?
Did you mention which, why is electricity awesome?
Electricity involves three different malachas. Eish, and bone, maka bepatish, and bone. And the question is whether it's an ish of the, is it an av malach or a tolder? Tolder it is. Perhaps it's not a tolder, perhaps it's only the Rabbanon. According to the Chazon Ish, and by the way, the Rav, if I'm not mistaken, agreed with the Chazon Ish. It's a suffix ish of the Oraita. That's what I recall. Okay, but anyway, you can see with electricity, you know what you can look into? Shmirat Shabbat Gehilchata. He has a world on it, and he consulted with Rav Shlomo Zalman. And
Shlomo Zalman wrote a
more than a chaver. He wrote a whole sefer dealing with problems of Chashmal. Okay, so to reiterate, we saw the tshuva driving electricity. What you can watch, what you can watch, what you can't watch. Then we went in, you know, with all that was going in the ivory tower, the reality on the ground was very different. And I said a few words about the Haredi world, and I certainly, we have to compliment them. They have succeeded in blacking out of these problems. They've made it clear we are not going to innovate. And this is the way we dress, this is the way we live. We are a closed society with all that that implies. Do they have total success? Absolutely not. Do I want to be Haredi? Certainly not. But we have to give credit where credit is due. The minute you live in two worlds, you are affected by both worlds. There's the interaction, there's the challenges. I realize they're affected too. I'm well aware of it.
You know, the internet has gotten through to them. Yeah, I know.
I understand everything. Oh, yeah. But nevertheless, no one is clamoring in Borough Park to have women get aliyot and have women read the Torah. No one is clamoring, to the best of my knowledge. You say give it 20 years, I'm not certain. But it doesn't matter. The seminary was exposed, and that exposure created ripples. The ripples created waves. You saw it in 73 already, when Professor Mandelbaum could not win the election, although he had many people on the faculty supporting him and not supporting Gerson Cohn, who already was open to innovation, although in his own personal life he certainly was observant. But Professor Mandelbaum, I certainly can testify, he was totally observant, a good Borough Park Jew, a Talmud Chacham, who published on Medrash. You can check it out on the websites. This ad in 1983 was overwhelming. Okay, now, Sam, what did you want to ask?
You mentioned that the ad is from 1983, and you also mentioned that Lieberman died.
We're going to come to that. We're going to come. Right, so we haven't come to Liebman's death yet.
After the
ad. Liebman's death, one
you
second.
The
no. Liebman died that year. I believe he died before the ad. And that I'm not only believe, I'm positive. Can someone look it up on a website, Liebman's month
so
of death?
Is that end symbolic?
You're going to see next week. It's more than symbolic. The you're going to see the overthrow black and white. I'm going to show it to you black and white. Yes.
The way like the United Synagogue
No, the United Synagogue, when they vote on JTS, they had votes. It's not that they elect,
like,
of course.
Why
yeah, they had input, absolutely. It's like YU in that respect, absolutely. Mendel, you wanted to ask something?
I'm just going to ask if Moshe Greenberg and Dominic Scholl happened to be the professor of Bible.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about.
So he was Orthodox in Russia?
He was orthoprax in his life, although not Orthodox. Gentlemen, a few goodies. If anyone here has gone to Shalavim, this is from the 50th anniversary of Shalavim. It has a complete listing of all their graduates in Israel and their graduates who have come in Aliyah from the foreign students program with addresses and emails. If anyone wants it, you're welcome. And there I have as well their five CDs dealing with the history of Shalavim, and I don't have to tell you, very beautiful, very emotional, the Kabbalah, the battles. One more Bamishpacha, which was my personal one, open to anyone who wants it. Be'ezrat Hashem, on Sunday I pick up with an unbelievable commentary by the Samim Rosh in his commentary on the Rush, with a story of Makubal, as you'll see, it's beyond words what the human mind can come up with. And Monday, Sammy's question will be answered black and white and very powerfully. Until we meet again in health and happiness with all good prayers for speedy work at Geffen Press, Das Vedanya. Thank you very, very much. Yitzchak, thank you. Very fascinating. You see what an honest man he was, that he kept the ledger, recorded the money. Wow.
Who's putting out your Geffen Press?
OU and Geffen. OU. Well, if you take one, you got to take the other.
Oh, yeah?
To have full Hana.
Are they living there? What do we mean?
No, it gives you the history. The CD gives you the history.
It's a big step going from you know more to say that you can change things. Just because we know certain things doesn't mean we should go around changing
things. Well, you're saying it's a big step. To them, it was a very small step. You follow? Very small step.